Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Quick, the year is presently 2023. When it comes to big money races, who's the first person that comes to mind? Now, there's a good chance the name Matt Hirschman rolled off the tip of your tongue, or at least came to mind. You know, having been involved in racing the last 35, 40 years, and having read about decades prior to that, you know, there's definitely an ebb and flow with the sport, and currently it seems like big money races or prestigious races, big stages, are where people are at. I don't think they'll always be there. It might go back to point loyalty and chasing championships that way, but for the moment, it really seems to be about the big stage. Now, back in the 80s, Rick Zemla was the king of the big stage at Beechridge. It's hard enough to win. It's even harder to back it up. To win three or four races each year is something to be said. But how about back-to-back seasons where you win 12 races each season? And this is a division that includes Bob Randall, Mike Maeda, Mike Johnson, all Beechridge Hall of Famers, some Maine State Maine Hall of Famers. It's a very stout class, and Rick bested them all over the course of a couple of years. We'll talk about that, but before we get to it, we'll do a little background on Rick, where he comes from, the one person who didn't want him to race, and how he had some help from a very famous person in the area of Southern Maine. Thank you so much for your support on Season 3 of Open Trailer. It's been amazing. Patreon has picked up, and really appreciate your contribution there, whether it's a one-time donation or you are a Patreon member, where you do get early access to the episodes. Matter of fact, they'll drop on Tuesday instead of an Open Trailer Thursday. Patreon.com/Open Trailer Podcast. That's Patreon.com/Open Trailer Podcast. You know, a lot of people will donate $5 a month or $10 a month. It's greatly appreciated, keeps this machine going, and pays for the streaming, all that stuff. I've been through it on other podcasts, so you know the drill by now. Thank you again for those who contribute to Patreon. Rick Zemla is an incredible individual. I was able to wrestle him from the golf course to sit down in the Open Trailer Studios and sit back for a chat. ...2018 member of the Bay Motorsports Hall of Fame. Back-to-back wins, or back-to-back seasons where you won 12 races as, you know, career highlights. Rookie of the Year on the NASCAR North Tour. All things that we'll get into and things that people already know you from. But what about Rick, who's coming through school? You said you grew up in Portland, so you're a Portland Bulldog.
No, Daring High School.
Daring. Did you play any sports?
Yeah, football, basketball, baseball.
And which one did you succeed in?
I wasn't a star in any of them. I enjoyed them, but I don't really remember too much about them.
That's cool. I think sometimes, you know, people play high school sports, you know, for the camaraderie with, you know, people that you go into school with. But when does racing come into your life?
Well, if you want me to go back to it, when it exactly came.
Day one.
I was like 4 or 5 years old because my father worked with Ralph Cusack on the race car.
Oh, wow. The old Blue Deuce?
Yeah. And I used to go to Beechridge. I had to take a nap because I was so young to go, but I'd go to Beechridge. And my father would tow Ralph's car, and I've known Ralph well, I know Ralph's past, but I knew Ralph Cusack like that my whole life. And that's what got me into wanting to be in the races.
So tell me about those first nights at the racetrack as a spectator.
Oh, it was, I loved every minute of it. I mean, I wanted to be there no matter what. That was just something that stuck on me like nothing else.
And was there anybody else that you were a fan of?
Not really, but I because of my father also being a safety man out there, and I got to go out in the infield and on the track because the car was out there. Yeah. And when I was young, I got to meet Dick Walsenum and Dick Garrett and a bunch of the older guys that I didn't know. I was a young guy.
Yeah, I mean, Dick was the first champion of Beechridge back in 49. So I can imagine what it's like for, how old were you when you met Dick? Do you remember?
Oh, probably not. I mean, to talk to him and we know each other's name, probably around, I don't know, somewhere around 8, 9 years old.
That's got to be cool.
Yeah.
And at what point does your father help you get your first race car?
No, he didn't. My father didn't really want me to race.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
As a safety guy, I can kind of understand that.
Yeah, but he didn't really want me to race. I got my own car, and me and a couple buddies of mine, we fixed it up, and I tried it. I mean, we weren't very good because the car wasn't very good.
Right.
But
what did he say when you dropped that news that, okay, I want to go and do this myself?
My father?
Yes.
He told me, he says, you know, you can get hurt. You can do, you know, you can get hurt in those cars and you can ruin your job and ruin all this stuff. And I said, Dad, I don't want to talk about that. I said, I want to do it and that's the way it is.
And how old are you at this point?
Now?
No. Back then.
Oh.
When you're having this conversation with him.
Oh, that was, we couldn't race until we were 18 years old back then.
Oh, right.
Right, so I was just about getting out of high school.
Yeah. And so you mentioned, your dad said that he was worried about you could screw up your job. What kind of jobs did you have in high school?
I didn't have a job in high school. He told me if I played sports like I just said to you, I didn't have to work because I could play the sports.
Oh.
But when I got out of high school, I didn't want to go to a college class, and I went into the pipe fitter's apprenticeship program. And I became a pipe fitter and did that my whole life.
Wow, where did you work?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
I was on power plants. A lot of the employers that had me, I was in Portland, but then later on when I got better at what I was doing and learned a lot of stuff, I got to travel a lot.
Did you put up or help construct anything that we might recognize? When I drive by a building, I'm like, oh, my buddy Rick had something to do with that.
I worked on the whole deal of it, the old Union Mutual building over there.
Oh,
I was
wow.
on that from the day it wasn't even it was just coming out of the ground, and I was there until the end of it.
So you're an apprentice, getting ready to lay some pipe. You know, do you remember the first time that you were behind the wheel of a race car?
I don't exactly remember that part of it, but I know I graduated from Darren High School when I was 18, and I got a chance to drive a guy's car, and I drove it for 6 or 7 times.
Was your dad still the safety guy at this point?
Yeah.
And how did that go down?
He didn't stop me from doing it, but he wanted to.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have an incident where you guys had to meet face to face because you had an incident on the racetrack?
Yeah. I got in an accident it was just a little bit of a pileup because somebody spun out in front of us and it was in the turn that he was on.
Right.
And he came walking over to the car. He says, you know, I forget exactly what he said, but it was kind of like, see what happens?
Yeah, told you.
Yeah.
Told you. So what year are we talking about?
I graduated from Darren High School, and so be about 66.
You're starting in the, what is it, the C class that you were running?
No, I was in the B class, what they call the bombers.
Oh, okay. Bomber stood for B.
Yeah. C class came in the Late 60s. I don't think that first year that I was telling you about, I don't think they were there, but they came right after that.
All right.
Yeah.
So how quickly do you start to get the ropes of racing?
I got them when I was a kid, like I said, and my father was with Ralph Cusack.
So when Ralph, and of course, you had a relationship with Ralph throughout, you know, being a child and everything. So all of a sudden, you got a. Were you wearing a helmet when you first started driving? A helmet
at Beechridge?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you hear that people weren't racing with helmets or safety equipment.
We had to have them.
Yeah. Well, your dad was a safety guy. Yeah. I would assume that. Yeah, he'd definitely want to make sure you had a helmet. So. Does Ralph see you in the pits and say, oh, you're driving now?
Oh, that car that I told you, that first one that I was driving, I didn't know anything about it and didn't know how to do it. And I just asked him if he'd take it out in the warm-ups and try it out and just let me know what he thought.
Right, because at this point, he had already picked up some track championships.
Oh, yeah, many of them.
Yeah, he was the top dog, you know, at this time, so... what's the climate in the Beechridge pits at this time? I mean, what is what it was like around 66, 67?
It was new to me, and I was just totally happy with it. You know, I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on, but I didn't know all of it, but I enjoyed it. And then when I really got involved in it, that I started racing full-time was in 69.
And what kind of car were you driving at this point?
It was a Plymouth.
Rookie of the year in 69. Nice. Tell me about that year.
It was a lot of fun. The car went good. We had some top tens. I mean, no, we weren't winning or anything like that, but we had some top 10 races and stuff. And I was fortunate enough to end up getting the rookie of the year.
Those days, I'm sure there were like 7 or 8 guys that you were racing against for that actual rookie of the year.
Oh, yeah. It was Pete Peterson, Dick Walsenholm, Gardner Levitt, Homer Drew come in a little bit at that time. Yeah. Russ Nutting. Yeah. There was a bunch of them.
So you raced at Plymouth. How long do you race the Plymouth for?
2 years.
Yeah.
And then I did, well, I don't want to say I did well. I mean, I got Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, that's
a
big score.
And then the next year, a guy had a car, and he asked me if I wanted to drive it for him, and I ended up driving it for him. And that was a modified, and we really ended up getting Rookie of the Year in that, too.
So what was it like to get that? I don't know if it was a phone call that came through or he saw you in the pits, to have somebody notice you and say, you know what, I want you, I've seen what you've done out there in that Plymouth, I want you to drive my car.
I thought it was pretty special.
Yeah.
He actually owned Pete Peterson's car before me.
Oh, wow.
And that's when Pete Peterson got hooked up with Chummy Brown, and he needed somebody, and he asked me, and I ended up driving for him.
Yeah. So when you take that car, is that housed at your facility, and you're working on it every single night, or is that, you know, at that guy's place?
No, it was at my place.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he basically said, I want you to drive. Here's the car. Go work on it during the week.
Yeah.
Wow. Who was this guy?
Joe Kane.
And what number were you at this point?
Because I know 43.
Why 43?
That's when we got the Plymouth that I was driving before that.
Yeah.
That it was 43.
And you would... assume that you'd be 43 throughout your career, but that's not the case. I mean, how many numbers have you been?
Oh, my God. I couldn't even tell you how many numbers cars I had.
21, 17, 01, 77, one. Z1.
Yeah, and 1.
And 1.
Yeah.
Why'd you ever give up the 1? If I'm 1, I'm like, I'm never giving this up.
Well, the 1 was a modified.
Okay.
And the late model was the 01.
Mm.
And... that was just the way, you know, because of that.
So you're running in coupe, you know, these are coupe modifieds in the early 70s?
Yeah, yeah.
So what was it like to jump into that thing for the first time?
Pretty hairy.
Yeah. Did you think you were over your head?
Well, I don't know if I know that I, it, made you really think when you was in it, because they went pretty fast back in them days.
Yeah.
You know?
Was there somebody that pulled you aside and said, hey, kid, you know, we see you out there, but here's how you can do it a little bit better?
Well, Dick Walsenhoom helped me out a lot.
Yeah, and you know, Dickie is somebody that comes up quite often in our conversations about your racing career. When did you guys first meet?
Well, I met him when he was driving, and I was just out there as a kid when my father was working the track.
Mm-hmm.
But probably 17 or 18, I got to know Dick, and he helped me out with a lot of stuff on the car.
What's something about Dick Walsenhoom that most people wouldn't expect? Because I think you knew him differently than a lot of people did.
I don't know what other people really expected of him.
Wild party guy.
Yeah.
I'll just come right out and say it. You know, very gregarious. The life of the party. Take no prisoners on the racetrack. And, you know, I'm going to do it my way or the highway.
That was him.
Yeah.
That was him for sure.
But I think sometimes when you are like that, you know, you're like that, that's your public persona, but someone like you who got to know him a little bit differently, or say his wife Phyllis, could tell us a different side of Dickie that maybe the public didn't see.
Well, he helped me out with a lot of stuff, and other people did say some things that he wouldn't give him a hand on anything, you know.
Why you, though?
I don't know. But we were very good friends for a good many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still good friends with Phyllis to this day.
Yeah. Didn't you end up having a house near his property?
Mm-hmm. I bought the land off his mother.
Isn't that cool to live next to like Dick Walsenhoom?
It wasn't. We weren't side by side, but I was down the road from him just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first time that you beat him.
Geez, I don't even know if I can remember that. First time, no. I beat him some times when I got older and stuff, but in the beginning, I don't remember. I don't ever remember beating him.
All right.
When I was young, that modified that I said I had, I finished second to him one night.
By a lot, or did you have a chance at him?
I don't really think I had a chance at him, but I was right behind him, yeah.
What was Dickie's line on the racetrack?
He liked to drive on the straightaways out towards, just the same way I did in the end too, but he liked to drive out towards the wall.
Yeah.
That's where I liked it. I just thought you could get better speed there.
Well, now the place is closed down and statute of limitations have passed. What is the best way? Well, I mean, you raced at both asphalt and dirt. Let's stick with dirt chronologically here. What was the secret way to get around Beechridge?
Oh, the real thing was missing the holes, because once you started racing and everybody was racing at night, you had all kinds of holes on the track.
What kind of track lighting was there? Were you able to see the holes?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. They weren't as big and stuff as they were at the end of it, but you could see the track with the lights, yeah. Mm.
And at this time, J.B. McConnell's probably still owns the racetrack.
No.
No?
No.
Did you have any interaction with J.B.?
Well, I drove a car for Warren Hamilton, who was his grandson.
Mm.
Yeah. So I met him a lot and stuff like that, yeah. But I really was never really tight with him or anything, no. Right.
Not while he was running the racetrack. So you came mainly under the Calvin Reynolds era?
Yeah, JB owned it when I first started, but he just sat in his car all the time. He was never out associating with anybody.
Hmm.
He'd park in the infield and he'd make his night right there.
Huh.
Yeah.
That seems like something that like Tom Mayberry does these days. I don't know if he does it anymore, but there was a time when he would just sit in the infield in his car, and I always thought that was a little weird, but maybe he learned it from JB. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
All I know is JB did it. Yeah. I mean, like, if you want to race or anything like that, and they pull you over and they're talking to you and stuff like that, he never come out. I mean, he kept his distance, and I don't mean he meant that he didn't like anybody.
Right.
He just didn't get involved in doing that stuff.
Yeah, he was trying to separate business from from muddying the waters if you're friends with somebody and maybe bending the rules for them.
Right.
Creating track favorites,
right.
as that
right.
happens. Do you remember your first win?
Yeah. 76.
Wow. So you had been at it for 10 years. Is that,
yep.
If you started it in 66, 10 years, did you ever think that it was going to happen to you?
No. I didn't know, but I got to finish a lot of seconds and I finished in the top 10 in the point standings, but I wasn't up with the guys that were doing all the winning, the Cusacks and the Walsenhooms and the Garretts. And Homadrew, I wasn't up there with them at that time.
Who was the toughest guy that you were competing with mid-70s?
Homadrew. Ralph Cusack got out of racing a lot in the mid-60s. He was doing other stuff. Homadrew was tough to beat. Dick Walsenhoom was tough to beat. Ray Leach was tough to beat.
Mm.
Yeah. And there was quite a few of them.
Tell me about that first night in 76 when you won.
Oh, that I bought hot dogs and clams for all the people that worked around my race car and were around me and gave them a big party at my house that week.
I was going to say, where did the hot dogs and clams come from? If they weren't serving clams at Beechridge.
No. I bought them after I won that race. And that week before the next weekend, we had a big party in the yard.
Mm. So this is 1976. Tell me about your family life. I mean, what is a week like for you? I mean, there's Rick Zemla, the race car driver, with many different numbers. But, I mean, you have a pretty important job in and around Portland. You have a wife. You have a family that you're raising as well. What's that schedule like?
Rough.
Yeah?
Yeah, I worked a lot of jobs in the pipe fitting, and then we had some kids.
Hmm.
And, you know, you always got something going there. I was at their T-ball games and all that kind of stuff when they were little.
It's interesting that, you know, present day, T-ball happens generally on Saturday mornings,
mm-hmm.
You know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of times people don't race as many times as they would if they didn't have the family dynamic that they do. So let's go back to the 70s. And how many children did you have?
In the 70s, I had three.
Okay, so you had three, and they're all involved in T-ball. On race day, which is primarily, you know, Saturday race day, you would go to T-ball in the morning and then work on the race car?
No. Back then, the T-ball and those games were played at night.
Oh.
During the week.
Well, that worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. But, I mean, because I wasn't working on the race car, but I coached my son. I coached his team. So I had sometimes two games a week. But, you know, it was fun, and you got to do a little bit with them.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a lot, you know, because pipe fitting isn't exactly banker's hours, you know?
No.
I mean, what you're going to work what time in the morning?
7.
Yeah.
And work till 4:30.
And then you're going to be coach.
Yeah.
And where'd you fit in the racing?
The working on them?
Yeah,
I had a nice crew when I was younger.
Yeah.
I had a lot of young guys that like me, and there was like three or four of them. We worked on cars all the time.
Who are these people? Do you remember their names?
Tom Kimble, Warren Hamilton, I can't think of his name now, but he's been been away for a long time from me, but he was he was a big help. Mm. Yeah.
Let's go back to that first win where you talked about how you bought, you know, the clams and the hot dogs for everybody. What was it like to get out of that race car as a winner with that, you know, crowd right there?
I was very nervous.
Really?
Yeah, I have a hard time talking to people.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, I mean, well, even when I was winning and when I got older, Bruce Elder came to me one night and he says, "Hey, Rick, when we're talking to the grandstands, you got to answer more than yes and no."
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you're doing a great job today.
He said, "You got to try." Yeah, because people aren't here.
Oh, okay. I'm people.
Yeah.
Kind of.
But no, he said, he told me one night, he says, "Hey, Rick," he says, "you know, when I ask you a few questions about how things went in the race and stuff like that, you got to try to at least answer it a little bit so that the people in the grandstands know what is going on."
Right.
And I just told him, I said, "I don't mean to be rude, but I said, it's kind of hard on me to do it."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have anxiety when you'd cross the checkered, you know, you checkered flag would fly and then you're cooling down the race? At what point you're like, "Oh my God, I got to go talk to people now"?
Well, that kind of was always in my head. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I just didn't like doing it. It's not that I didn't like the people.
Right.
It's just that I had a hard time doing it.
Yeah. And you start developing a fan base at this point too, because you start winning a lot.
Yeah.
You know, how many trophies, how many wins do you have total, would you say?
I believe when I went into the Hall of Fame, I believe it was 58.
Wow. 58 on that surface, the old clay surface, which, you know, is full of holes. It changes from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you said something about a couple minutes ago where you were talking about how the guys were, you were running second and third a lot, right? And you were up there in the point standings, but, you know, you weren't winning a lot, which is a little bit different than how I know you. You know, to me, you are a person that's always, just look at your stat sheet, gone after wins. I mean, not many people have multiple double-digit win seasons, let alone back-to-back, which you did in the early 80s. But it seems to me that, at least in the early days, you were a bit of a points racer, too.
Yeah, I was trying to win every night, but I mean, there was just a lot of good guys out there that, you know, they were tough to beat. Mm-hmm. I won in the 70s. I won, I think the grand total of winning, I finished in the top 10 in points those years, but I had 4 wins in the 70s.
Yeah. How much money would you get out of the point fund for that championship, but, you know, like, say you finished 7th in the points, what kind of money are we talking about?
I honestly don't know. Own the cars.
Oh, okay. So what was the split? What did you get to keep?
Oh, they just gave me, Joe Kane and them guys, they'd give me they'd just give me some money.
Really?
I didn't really, when I was winning all the races that you were talking about, the double race seasons.
Yeah, 82.
I was getting 30%.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's still a good payday.
Yeah.
How long does this relationship with your car owner last? The one where you won your first race? The guy that gave you the modified? Joe.
Joe?
Yeah.
I raced with Joe. Well, Joe actually worked on my cars when I was driving for somebody else. And then once that guy went to work for Mike Maeda, and I got in my other vehicles, he come over and started working on them, and then he bought the cars. So,
can you explain that to me again? So yeah. You would be driving, right? Mm-hmm. You'd have your own cars,
yeah.
And then you guys got together, and then, yeah, I guess you kind of lost me on that one.
Well, he worked on the cars in the our crew.
Okay.
Right.
So Joe worked on the cars that you were driving.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were going out, you were winning these races, you were top 10 in points.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does this last?
Well, with Joe, it lasted until I went to NASCAR.
Really?
When I went to NASCAR, his brother-in-law was racing, and he got his brother-in-law to drive the car. And then his brother-in-law left the car, and when I come back from NASCAR, I went back racing with him.
Who was his brother-in-law?
Billado.
Oh, no, really?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's wrong. His daughter was racing a couple years ago, and he was out there, but he helped build the car, but his daughter raced.
On Saturdays?
Yeah.
Oh, Dave Lamprin.
Yeah.
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 Dave Lamprin. Yeah, his daughter Taylor.
Yeah. Dave Lamprin, right. Yeah. When I went to NASCAR, he got a car and Dave Lamprin drove it.
The 76?
No, it was...
Oh, 21.
Yeah.
The 21 car. Yeah. Okay, now I remember.
And he did it over and Dave Lamprin drove that. And then I was driving that, and then the guy came along that wanted me to go into that Regal that I raced at the end of it. And when that happened, Joe Walker got a modified, and Lamprin drove his modified.
Yeah, that was such a beautiful car, that 76. I always remember that, just never being just a hair off of it.
Yeah.
So we just had Dave Cudamarsh in here. He's a guest on the podcast this year. How come you guys never seem to hook up? It seemed like you guys are both in the same lane. You like to win. He liked to win. You're both fast. How come you guys never hooked up?
I don't know. Well, Ralph Cusack was with him.
Hmm.
And then...
But he's looking for a guy, and then Tommy Oliver is the guy in 82? 81, 82? 81.
Yeah, but that was when I had my own modified.
Ah,
that white number one.
I bet you, I mean, we're obviously just kind of playing fantasy at this point, but I mean, you had some real successful years in 82 and 83. You won 12 races each year in late model. I bet you if you two teamed up in that modified, that would have been wild. That would have been, you know, everybody's racing for second. Because you seem to take to the modifieds. Which did you prefer, modifieds or full-bodied, you know, G-body, late-model sportsman cars?
I liked them both.
Yeah.
I liked them both. I drove both of them. Some years I drove both classes, and I enjoyed both of them.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You know, I mean, one of your idols, Dick Walston Hume, he was king of the full moon. Where, you know, I mean, he won two track championships same year. I think it was like 68. And I think he might have done it again, too. But point being, multiple classes. Very few people can be successful at both disciplines. You're one of them.
Home Maduro.
Yeah, he's another one. I mean, you're in a very small class of guys.
Ralph Cusack, Home Maduro, Dick Walston. I did.
Maeda did for a while.
Maeda, yeah, that was after I was out, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bob Gahan, you know.
Yeah, Bob Gahan did both.
Now we're doing more in the 80s, but I mean, there were nights when you would win both races, and there were multiple nights where you would win three races in one night. Can you tell me about one of those nights?
Yeah, it was, I mean... I couldn't believe it at the time either. I mean, when something like that happens, you just say, wow, how did all that happen? But
yeah,
it did. And we had a double race meet out there one night because the features got rained out from the week before.
Double features means a long program.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get any time to rest at all.
No, because when they go out there, they run the held over features first. And then when they're all over, then you go into the regular night.
Right. So you got to have some different setups, too, because, I mean, if you're running, you know, during the daytime, daylight hours, because I assume the races started at 7 back then.
Yeah.
7:30. I mean, you're not, you know, you have that, the heat. Would the heat ever manipulate the way the racetrack raced?
That was back when it was clay.
Right. So I know it does for asphalt. Does it for would it for the clay?
I don't know. I think on real hot nights. I don't know as far as making it slippery or anything like that. I don't know anything about that part of it, but I think it chewed it up a lot, and a lot of chunks come out of it, and you had some potholes.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I've interrupted your story about winning three races in one night. That seems to be pretty paramount. tell me about that night.
Oh, it was the Triple Crown series, and I won the modified race at the beginning of the night, and then I won the late model race at the beginning of the night, and then we went into the regular one, and I won the late model again in the regular night.
So the handicap system has you starting out back no matter what.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you win all those races. Multiple wins on any night is going to get a lot of people's attention. How scrutinized was your vehicle or vehicles?
Oh, they wanted to tear it down every single night. Yeah. No, and, you know, I guess you might call me a crybaby. I don't know. But I told Ralph Cusack, I said, Ralph, every night, if I win a race, they want to tear the car down. I said, then we got to go back and put the motor all back together and stuff. I said, you know, why do they have to do it every single night? And he did something, and he told them they weren't going to do it every night. But I got torn down about every three nights.
No kidding. Can you tell me about someone who wanted to tear you down?
Sonny Lorenzo, Bob Babb, Bob Bilodeau.
So this is strictly over the engine. This is before soaking tires and...
They did everything. When they say they're going to tear it down, they did everything. They checked the brake systems and everything on it. But they took parts of the motor apart so that they could see it.
And they never found anything, huh?
No, I never got disqualified because of it.
Who was doing your motors?
Ken Wood. Ken Wood, he was a very older guy. He used to be the head man at Napa in the garage in building stuff. And he had retired, and he wanted to work on the race cars, and we took him to the races every week.
Wow.
And he built all my motors.
That's amazing. So both modified and late model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how many laps, 35 laps, 30 laps for the features? I mean, so you're running with heats and practice and everything like 200 laps a night in these cars. You ever wake up the next day with just jelly arms, or how much fatigue did you have throughout the night?
I don't really remember any of it because I was pretty young. And besides that, you know, pipe fitting wasn't an easy job. Carrying pipe, hooking it up and stuff like that, you know. So I don't really ever remember having any real pains about it.
Right. So there's a night where, where Mike Rowe won that infamous race where he had a bloody hand and everything in the Coup de Marche 61.
I was second.
Second. Can you tell me about that?
Homer Drew was third.
That's quite the top three. Mike Rowe, Rick Zemla, Homer Drew. Can you tell me about that race?
Yeah. Mike Rowe actually went off the track. And he went down over the three turn. And I thought he lost a lap. But Mike Rowe and I are good friends. To this day, we're good friends.
That's great.
And I wouldn't badmouth him in any way, shape, or form. But I thought that he had lost a lap. But... who am I? I'm in a race car. I saw him go off, and all of a sudden he's back.
Right.
And he beat me. I mean, it was a pretty much race like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Homer was third.
Cool stories from Rick in stage number one. He mastered Beech Ridge, that's been established, but then he goes on the NASCAR North Tour, where he's competing with the likes of Randy LaJoie, Robbie Crouch, Jean-Paul Cabana, and Chuck Bown. Well, he and Chuck had an interesting run-in at Thunder Road. you end up upside down. What happens?
I think I got a little push from Chuck Baum, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And it caught the wall that laid back, like you said.
Yeah, Widowmaker.
Yeah. And
was that the first time that you've been over like that?
No, I did it once at Beechridge. That one there got kind of high in the air, so I didn't really care for that one.
Yeah. That's next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you for tuning in.